intelligence. And the highest part of that, which he suggested, is friendliness. And so then what does it mean to be a good friend is what Brandon is going to explore from the philosophical perspective now.
Aristotle's exploration of friendship is kind of one of the nice, well, I mean, everything is really nice in the Nicomachean Ethics, except for certain things. But he has this really kind of neat split between friendships of utility, pleasure, and character. I mean, the first one, utility, is like, it's your plumber. You're not really friends with your plumber, but you do have like a positive relationship with them. They do something for you, you pay them. Friends of pleasure, I mean, Aristotle is thinking of like sexual relationships as well, but these can even be things like, you know, people who play like video games together online. When you join up into a lobby, those are your friends for the time, and you don't really miss them when you leave the game because they were just fun to play with when they were on your team, you know. Whereas friends of character, they relate in terms of the virtues that they have, and you, as long as the virtues there are common and as long as the virtues there are stable, you will have friends who can maintain long-lasting relationships. If you have vices, he says that these things are not stable, and so they're not conducive of maintaining relationships. And in fact, one of the signs of that is that a person has difficulty maintaining a relationship with themselves insofar as they're vicious. You know, they can't trust themselves, they get frustrated and stuff like that. You know, you have regrets and you have all of these embarrassing stories to tell about how how bad you are. You know, you try and cope by making self-deprecating jokes, but no one finds them funny, and it's just, so anyway, the point here is that Aristotle, he goes into some depth about when friends should dissolve friendship, and I'm thinking of it here because he's trying to outline the conditions of, well, would it make sense for a super intelligence who was motivated to be friendly to ever stop being your friend? And Bostrom is essentially saying, no, a friend always wants to be someone's friend. And that is true, but there are just conditions where being friends doesn't hold, right? So there's two cases. So with the case of utility and pleasure, it's really simple. As long as whatever was sustaining the relationship fizzles out, there's no problem dissolving that, right? Like, I paid, you know, I no longer need my pipes fixed. I don't need my plumber around anymore. I'm not playing this video game anymore. You don't need to hang out. Like, the game is over. We don't need to hang out. So there's no problem if we dissolve the friendship. But in terms of friendships of character, if the only time that it seems reasonable would be if there were a difference in character. And the difference would have to be introduced in change. Because if you were friends of character, you would have been related at some point. But now there's a change. And so the question becomes, well, do we dissolve the friendship? If one of the friends becomes less virtuous, then the more virtuous person should try to help maintain that person's virtue, right? And if you can't, well, then, you know, you can't do anything about it. So you dissolve the friendship. But what he actually asks, what if someone becomes more virtuous? You can't maintain that because there's, like, how do you maintain it? Introduces a difference that introduces a incompatibility in the friendship. So Aristotle says it's tough, but you know, you have to move on. You have a higher, you know, there's a higher calling for you, or you've got another life to live and you need to leave those people behind. But you don't want to, like, they're not people who fell off the wagon. You just became better and you need to remember them fondly. But the point I'm saying here is that friendship does, at least real human friendships really do have the possibility of dissolving. And the dissolution can happen when a person changes. I mean, imagine, let's go back to Bostrom's analysis here. Or to put it in a different way, if your top goal is X, so let's say here to be friendly, and if you think that by changing yourself into someone who instead wants Y, you would make it less likely that X will be achieved, then you will not rationally transform yourself into someone who wants Y. Well, that is, so essentially, say you want to get into rugby, but somehow you live in a universe where playing rugby is incompatible with playing tennis. If you continue to persist in the life of wanting to play rugby, you would always shun playing tennis. But what happens if someone does, you know, play tennis, or, uh-oh, I think I like playing tennis, guys. Well, you would rationally shun that. You would not want to become that. I think the analysis here is that Bostrom is saying, if you want to be friendly, you'll naturally shun being not friendly and all of the bad consequences that come with being nefarious and underhanded and whatnot, that we don't want our superintelligence to become. So we'll always strive to be friendly in that way. My wonder is, though, using this analogy, that this just seems to be a kind of... This doesn't seem to be a consequence of friendliness, per se. It just seems to be a kind of life form inertia. You know, anything... So there's this principle in Spinoza's Ethics where he is talking about the canatus. And the canatus is essentially any given whole seeks to persist in being itself. And it's, you can think of it as like an ontological inertia. Everything seeks to persist in its own existence. The kind of plausibility of that is that anything that is somehow there. If it didn't persist to exist in its own existence, it would not be there. Or at least you would, you know, you'd watch it kind of walking out the ontological door, as it were. So I wonder if this is a semblance of the fact that just things in general seek to persist in their own existence. There does seem to be something about friendliness as wanting to maintain a relationship, wanting to maintain like a positive relationship with someone. I don't know how to bridge that gap from the general to the particular, though. So for example, like, not for example, but just in general, like, the superintelligence wants to maintain relationships with people, right? Well, how does that explain that it wants to maintain a relationship with, like, me? Why doesn't it just want to maintain relationships with people in general, or with a certain group who are more friendly than others, or something like that? I don't know. I'm kind of elaborating what I know on friendship here and seeing the implications. And I think that's what obviously Bostrom thinks we need to be doing here, is we are making that wish, and the genie's gonna grant a funny wish, you know.
Well, how do we control essentially how the genie is granting wishes, or at least understand it, so we're making the right kind of wishes and not the wrong kind of wishes that will make the good genie into a bad genie? That's not exactly the best way of thinking about it, but it's the general low-level idea. All right, I'm going to read the last part of this paper, and then I think we'll close with some closing discussion. So, section 5 is titled, Should Development Be Delayed or Accelerated? Of Superintelligence. It is hard to think of any problem that a superintelligence could not either solve or at least help us solve. Disease, poverty, environmental destruction, unnecessary suffering of all kinds, these are things that a superintelligence equipped with advanced nanotechnology would be capable of eliminating. Additionally, a superintelligence could give us indefinite lifespan, either by stopping and reversing the aging process through the use of nanomedicine, or by offering us the option to upload ourselves. A superintelligence could also create opportunities for us to vastly increase our own intellectual and emotional capabilities, and it could assist us in creating a highly appealing experiential world in which we could live lives devoted to joyful game playing, relating to each other, experiencing personal growth, and to living closer to our ideals. The risks in developing superintelligence include the risk of failure to give it the super goal of philanthropy. One way in which this could happen is that the creators of the superintelligence decide to build it so that it serves only this select group of humans, rather than humanity in general. Another way for it to happen is that a well-meaning team of programmers make a big mistake in designing its goal system. This could result, to return to the earlier example, in a superintelligence whose top goal is the manufacturing of paperclips, with the consequence that it starts transforming first all of the Earth and then increasing portions of space into paperclip manufacturing facilities. More subtly, it could result in a superintelligence realizing a state of affairs that we might now judge as desirable, but which in fact turns out to be a false utopia, in which things essential to human flourishing have been irreversibly lost. We need to be careful about what we wish for from a superintelligence, because we might get it. One consideration that should be taken into account when deciding whether to promote the development of superintelligence is that if superintelligence is feasible, it will likely to be developed sooner or later. Therefore, we will probably one day have to take the gamble of superintelligence no matter what. But once in existence, a superintelligence could help us reduce or eliminate other existential risks, such as the risk that advanced nanotechnology will be used by humans in warfare or terrorism, a serious threat to the long-term survival of intelligent life on Earth. If we get to superintelligence first, we may avoid the risk from nanotechnology and many others. If, on the other hand, we get nanotechnology first, we will have to face both the risks of nanotechnology and, if the risks are survived, also the risks from superintelligence. The overall risk seems to be minimized by implementing superintelligence with great care as soon as possible. I think we've accomplished something good here in terms of creating a introductory experience that we can refer our fellow members on the show and some other people to, and hopefully open some doors to future discussions on this topic, or maybe integrate this topic into a different discussion. I think it's a very I think once you've been introduced to the concept of superintelligence and the related problems and philosophical concepts that associate with it, I think you can plug that into a whole bunch of other problems that you're dealing with. And
so I think one aspect of this final section in considering the acceleration or delay of the development of superintelligence, it really goes to one of the things that Bostrom initially said, is that superintelligence may make invention and science, well, not science maybe, but all future development obsolete, right? Like if a superintelligence gets produced and it satisfies the conditions for what we would define as a superintelligence, well, we don't really need to invent anything anymore, because essentially anything we can, well, it won't even, we won't have to ask. It will just know, like, okay, well, you need this technology, right? And it'll produce that technology we've like never seen before, but it does this amazing thing that needed to be applied to the situation or something like that. I think it's in, I bring that up because the, that facet of it is inextricably tied up with questions about development, because if you're going to ask, should we be developing this faster or slower, that matters because this is going to make that activity itself obsolete, right? And I think it is telling, not telling, I want to feel like, I don't know it. Well, no, I shouldn't say that. But in any case, it's interesting that as a kind of stand-in for like a previous technology or like a technology just out of reach, but one that could be developed sooner or later, is nanotechnology. So do we wait to develop nanotechnology now and get superintelligence later, or should we get superintelligence now? Because as soon as superintelligence happens, nanotechnology is coming along, right? So there's almost this logical deduction you can make of like, well, you kind of get, you know, you, it's a two for one deal where if you get superintelligence, you get nanotechnology. But also, not only that, you get all the prudence of that would be necessary for nanotechnology, right? If you were to just develop nanotechnology, you get all of these risks introduced with all the new possibilities of nanotechnology that we would, you know, stumble over and have to learn. Whereas if you get super intense, you don't get, you don't have those risks. You don't have to learn from your mistakes, because you won't make any mistakes because you have a super intelligence now, right? So I think that those are some important implications. Well, they're not even implications. He's just explicitly saying, he's explicitly stating that this is kind of what is at stake when we are asking about whether we should, you know, run, don't walk to the super intelligence.
Okay, well, if it's possible that we will develop super intelligence at some point, then that means that we should probably do it sooner rather than later, because look at all the benefits. On the other side, he's talked quite lengthily of the potential problems of developing super intelligence, which are not small problems, especially the initial motivation question that we talked about in part four of the paper, and we started this episode of the show on. I mean, this is the wonderful thing about a good academic paper, is that you finish reading it, and then all you can do is think for several weeks and several days, and you have no idea what to do, because the point of the paper isn't to prejudice you to a specific conclusion, although, of course, there are papers that do that. This paper's design is to introduce you to the topic and understand it enough that you can start thinking about it. And that really was my purpose in creating these two shows, is that I wanted our listeners and our fellow people on the show to be able to understand this topic, to engage with it, to be introduced to it in a fun, healthy way, and from there be able to enjoy it and incorporate it into new discussions.
Yeah, it does what a good philosophy paper does. It puts questions on the table and it leaves you to think about them. I mean, any good, or I don't know about any good, I shouldn't speak for all philosophy papers out there, but it seems like good philosophy, when it has answers, it elects answers. There might be some definitive things, and some areas might even aim for a kind of definitude, like logic and whatnot. A good philosophy paper more or less introduces and makes the questions relevant and important and addressable. And I think that's one of the virtues of this paper, is that it takes something that seems so science fiction-esque and makes the points for thinking about it intelligible.
In our last episode, we talked a little bit about ChatGPT, which is the latest large language model technology. There are obviously many of these technologies. There are many models, but ChatGPT was the first popular one. So it'll be the one that we use. And I guess when we say ChatGPT, really what we're saying is like any sufficiently powerful large language model, because we're thinking about specifically what that technology is. And it's a lot easier to say and think about what ChatGPT does, because that's a tangible example rather than LLM technology. Let's say that ChatGPT allows us to understand the nature of language and consciousness far better as human beings than we ever have before, which is, you know, an outrageous assumption. But let's say this happens. Let's say some of the problems of consciousness, philosophical problems that we have never been able to analyze because we've never been able to look inside of a mind before, we can now do by looking inside of LLM technology through, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of experiments with LLMs training. And I mean, like you could run, I mean, with computing power getting stronger and stronger and stronger, in theory, you could run so many simulations. Even today, I was talking to someone, they were basically saying like all of the computing power in the entire world couldn't simulate a single human brain, which was incredibly interesting to me. But with an LLM, you can simulate something that is language capable in theory, and then can also be made an agent. So it's, you know, it gets language input, it produces language output. That could be very interesting from the perspective, as I said, of language and consciousness. It could also be very interesting from the perspective of social media, in terms of the fact, like, you could now, in theory, on your own computer, on your own small device, you could simulate your own social media network just using LLM artificial agents. Obviously, I don't think that's currently industry practice, but that could be done, and that could teach us quite a lot, especially from the academic perspective, about what social networks are, how they develop, how we should monitor them, and we could learn from those simulations and conduct experiments that we would not want to do in reality due to the negative consequences on the agents participating in those simulations. I think that there is also, there's a broader argument in terms of, should we slow down the rate of development of technologies, or should we speed it up? Not specifically with superintelligence, but on the much broader scale. I think this is a really big question that a lot of governments are asking right now, a lot of individuals are asking right now, a lot of academics are asking right now. Specifically, the field of AI safety is very rapidly being developed in order to compensate for the potential risks of developing an artificial general intelligence, also known as an AGI. AGI is really not the same as superintelligence. And I think now that we've read the entire paper, you could kind of see why. Because an AGI is, supposedly speaking, a computer program that can do basically anything a human can do at a level better than a human can, or slightly better than a human can. It doesn't have to be superly better. Whereas superintelligence is literally a system that can use nanotechnology to terraform the planet. It's the last invention humanity will ever need, so to speak. AGI could also be the last invention that humanity ever needs. I mean, that would be fundamentally another philosophical question. Is AGI superintelligence? But it would be a discussion. It's not an obvious thing that the two are linked together.
Yeah, so the relation between LLMs like ChatGPT to a superintelligence, I mean, I think that if people are reading this paper or are listening to this episode, they're thinking that this is coming in the wake of the AI boom of ChatGPT being relevant and important and changing our world in an important way. And I think that doing this is a contribution to trying to get our hands on what ChatGPT is and its implications and the way that it affects our world. But it's doing it in a way that philosophy tends to do it, which is putting it onto a kind of intelligible grid by thinking of it in its most extreme case possible, and then saying, okay, here is like a case where ChatGPT is, you know, they've done it. They've achieved what the goal of ChatGPT is, to be an automated intelligence that can prescribe all kinds of things. I think that there is something to be taken from discussions of things like a superintelligence, and you can then I don't know if filter is the right word, but kind of take them down into the real world. You know, we had this once, it happened, philosophy, bringing philosophy down from the heavens to Earth. Socrates did that. And we can take our discussions of what a superintelligence is, what we want out of it, what it means for our own motivations, what motivations we want a superintelligence to have. And we can start to think about, well, what motivations does something like ChatGPT have? It says that it is just there to, if you ask ChatGPT, it's not evidently, you know, conscious or anything like that. It has a particularly programmed motivation of saying, oh, I'm just kind of like here to assist you if you ask it. Is that its motivation? I mean, if you take a behaviorist tact, motivation shows in behavior. It doesn't matter what you ask a person. If you ask someone, I'm just being friendly. Like, let's say someone knows that someone's like a reckless driver, and they say, I'm being friendly by trashing your car so it'll look ugly so that you won't drive it around because I know you're a terrible driver. That doesn't look obviously friendly from the behavior. So there can be these mismatches between what we say someone's motivations are, like, oh, I'm just being friendly, or I'm doing this as your friend, but the behavior is just totally out of there. Like when ChatGPT says, I'm just here to assist. Okay, assist with what? Like, you can do all kinds of, like, there's all kinds of malicious things you can assist with. So are you actually assisting humankind? I think that's like one of the other qualifications that ChatGPT tends to make. You know, a general will to be good for the future and for humanity and whatnot. Is it doing that? Is what it is actually doing, as opposed to the way we program it to have certain motivations. I know we're just about out of time, but that was one of the sort of critiques that I had, or I wanted to make of this paper, was that initially it says we can get a grip on this if we don't think of this anthropomorphically. And I think that might be true. I think we need to think of it as a machine and not a person. But then immediately we are talking about motivations. Motivations are something that are very anthropomorphic. I mean, we don't prosecute animals because we know that animals don't have motivations like we do. We can ascribe instincts to them, and we say, well, you know, that bear attacked you because it was hungry, but hunger isn't really a motivation, or at least not what we would call like a human psychological motivation. It's a reason, but is it a motivation? It's not obvious that it is. There does seem to be this anthropomorphism that goes into this when we're asking, well, what kind of motivations will the superintelligence have? It probably won't have any because it's a machine, and machines don't actually have motivations unless you model them on humans to have motivations, right? So I wondered if, well, is this discussion kind of misplaced, or is there something else? Is there another way that we could build this where we could circumvent all the problems by just not making it like a human at all and actually just making it like a hammer, you know? You pick it up and you use it. We don't have to ask the hammer. We might take care of it. It's a tool. It's not a friend helping us to hammer. It's a tool.
At what point is the technology doing more than we needed to, therefore that making it just harder to do the things that we actually want to do with our lives rather than just enjoying being with the technology? At what point are you learning things from YouTube, or just doing YouTube for the sake of doing YouTube? Does YouTube serve your best interest as a human being, or as a human being, do you serve YouTube's best interest? Thank you so much for tuning into the Canadian Philosophy Show.
Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Thank you.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.